Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is October the 2nd, 2019. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon and the other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, PRN.FM, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet and PCRadioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m., the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave me a message if you have any questions or comments at hank@pcradioshow.org. In the headlines, Match.com use fake IDs to swindle users. Hold off on the purchase of the new Apple iPhones and iPad. Microsoft removed CCleaner ban from their community forums. Sprint took FCC cash for serving 885,000 people it wasn't actually serving. Benjamin Rockwell, in his continuing IT Pro series, presents part 1 of 3 on bringing your own device to work. From the Tech Corner, is the Internet of Things ready for prime time? Marty Winston, with his technology perspectives, talking about the new rules for power tools.
Match.com used fake IDs to swindle users, says the Federal Trade Commission. In the lawsuit, the government agency contended that the dating site tried to dupe hundreds of thousands of consumers into buying dating subscriptions. The Federal Trade Commission sued the company behind the dating site, Match.com, saying that it had used fake advertisements in an attempt to swindle hundreds of thousands of consumers into buying the subscriptions. According to the complaint against Match Group, Inc., which was filed in the United States District Court for the Northern District of Texas, Match.com has employed 5 deceptive or unfair practices since 2013 to get consumers to subscribe to the site or to keep them subscribed. The Trade Commission also said Match.com had offered false promises or guarantees and failed to provide recourse for consumers who were unsuccessful in disputing charges. The site also made it difficult for consumers to cancel subscriptions, according to the lawsuit. Andrew Smith, the director of the Trade Commission's Bureau of Consumer Protection, said in a statement that they believe that Match.com conned people into paying for subscriptions via messages the company knew were from scammers. Match.group, whose headquarters are in Dallas, owns Tinder, OkCupid, and other dating sites, in addition to Match.com. Match Group said in a statement, the FTC has misrepresented internal emails and relied on cherry-picked data to make outrageous claims, and we intend to vigorously defend ourselves against these claims in court. The company said the FTC was overstating the impact of fraudulent accounts and that Match did not have data that supported the agency's claims. It also said that the majority of scams the Trade Commission had cited were spam, bots, or other users on the site. Match allows consumers to create free profiles on Match.com, but prohibits them from responding to messages without a paid subscription. The Trade Commission's lawsuit contends that Match.com sent emails to consumers with free accounts that suggested someone was interested in them. One example the FTC offered was an ad that read, "He just emailed you, and now he's expressed interest in you. Could he be the one?" The ads encouraged users to subscribe so they can see the identity of the person. According to the FTC complaint, Match's analysis found that from June 2016 to May 2018, consumers had purchased almost 500,000 subscriptions within 24 hours of receiving a fake ad. hold off on the purchase of the new Apple iPhones and iPad. With iOS 13.1.1 and iOS 13.1.2, as well as watchOS 6.01, all of the updates are focused on bug fixes. Apple has taken on an aggressive update of iOS 13. A rocky iOS 13 launch has led to an unusually brisk pace of bug fix updates. The iOS release fixes an issue that prevented Bluetooth connectivity, plus other that stopped the camera app and the flashlight from functioning in certain situations. Both the iOS and iPad OS updates fix a bug that left a progress bar still visible after iCloud backup completed its task. The update also righted another issue affecting shortcuts on HomePods. Just last Friday, Apple released iOS and iPad OS 13.1.1, a small bug fix update that repaired a security problem for third-party keyboard applications, whereby those apps could get permissions before users have given them, an issue that precluded iPhones from restoring from backups in some cases, and an issue affecting battery life. The update also included minor bug fixes for Apple's own apps like Safari and Reminders. Apple is continuing to update iOS 13 at a brisk breakneck pace. The company pushed out iOS 13.1.1 with a few bug fixes, and iOS 13.1 had only just launched on September the 24th. Fast forward today, and Apple's already rolling out iOS 13.1.2 and iPad OS 13.1.2. It's getting a little hard to keep these things in focus. The newest update addresses a handful of issues impacting iCloud backups. The camera fixes an issue where camera may not work, flashlight, Bluetooth, and the HomePod. It also patches up an unusual bug that could result in a loss of display calibration data. You wouldn't want that happening to your new iPhone 11 Pro display, would you? Well, of course not. You should be able to find the latest iOS and iPad OS update now by going to Settings, General, Software Update. But you need not complain about this. Apple's reputation is its ability to do rapid fixes. These rapid-fire bug fixes are a key benefit of Apple's control over both iPhone and iPad hardware and software. It's unfortunate iOS 13 have been shipped with all these issues that customers have encountered, but Apple is wasting no time in addressing them. Apple doesn't usually release so many updates in rapid succession. iOS 13 has already received 3 updates. As noted with iOS 13, it's a major and ambitious update compared to last year's iOS 12. But iOS 13 has had a relatively rocky beta period, and a number of kinks still needs to be ironed out even after today's updates. The recommendation is to hold off on the purchase of the new Apple iPhones and iPad. Wait until the rapid pace of updates have subsided. Why didn't Apple just wait for all the fixes in iOS 13 that are being rapidly released? iOS 13 was released September 19th, and here we are on October the 2nd with 3 updates. Why the rush? The rush to marketing took precedence over quality control. Delaying the release of iOS 13 would have held back the shipment of the new products. Why didn't they just hold it up? Microsoft removed CCleaner ban from their community forums. There are a couple of tools I use to maintain efficient operation of Windows. On a periodic basis, I use CCleaner to clean up garbage files. It is a small, effective utility for computers running Microsoft Windows that cleans out the junk that accumulates over time, temporary files, broken shortcuts, and other problems. I run also using Registry Cleaner to clean up the Windows registry and keep the system error-free and fast by removing redundant items like the registry files of already uninstalled software or shortcuts that have since been moved. I have tested and used other products, but I find that they are overly aggressive and generate false positives. I use the System File Checker tool which is built into the operating system to repair missing or corrupted system files. The SFC /scan now command, which runs under the command prompt under administrative mode, will scan all protected system files and replace corrupted files. It came as a surprise that Microsoft had banned CCleaner from their community forums. Microsoft has decided to roll back their decision to add CCleaner to a blacklist that would prevent the software's official site, ccleaner.com, from being posted in the Microsoft community forums. Earlier this week, it was reported that Microsoft community moderators were given a list of sites that were blacklisted in the community forums when users posted links to these sites in the forums. Microsoft software would replace them with 4*. This blacklist included the ccleaner.com site. Microsoft rolls back the decision. A source familiar with the matter said that CCleaner was originally banned due to Microsoft's general stance towards registry cleaners and system optimizers. Microsoft has long held the position that they do not support Windows registry cleaners or system optimizers, as they have a history of causing issues for those who run them, and many can be considered scams. Microsoft is not responsible for issues caused by using a registry cleaning utility. They strongly recommend that you only change values in the registry that you understand or have been instructed to change by a source you trust, and that you back up the registry before making any changes. While CCleaner has had its own share of controversies as both a registry cleaner and system optimizer, it has always had a good reputation and been well-liked by the user base. Therefore, it was a surprise when Microsoft decided to ban its domain from being posted on the Microsoft forums. The same source said that Microsoft had decided to remove this ban and will now allow CCleaner to be recommended again in the forums. It's not known what caused them to backpedal on their decision and if it had anything to do with communication between Microsoft, Avast, or Piriform. By the way, the using registry cleaner is on the Microsoft community forums. Sprint took FCC cash for serving 885,000 people it wasn't actually serving. Sprint admits a mistake, promises to pay money back, but could be punished by the FCC. Sprint has been caught taking millions of dollars in government subsidies for serving 885,000 low-income Americans who weren't using Sprint service. The Federal Communications Commission said today that Sprint violated the Lifeline Program's non-usage rule that requires providers of free subsidized plans to de-enroll subscribers who haven't used their phones recently. It's outrageous that a company would claim millions of taxpayers' dollars for doing nothing. This shows a careless disregard for program rules and American taxpayers. FCC Chairman Ajit Pai said, "I have asked our Enforcement Bureau to investigate this matter to determine the full extent of the problem and to propose an appropriate remedy." Sprint has admitted the mistake and said it will pay the money back, like the FCC's other universal service programs. Lifeline is paid for by Americans through fees imposed on phone bills. The FCC said Sprint's violation initially came to light as a result of an investigation by the Oregon Public Utility Commission. Because of that investigation, the FCC said it has learned that Sprint claimed monthly subsidies for serving approximately 885,000 Lifeline subscribers, even though those subscribers were not using the service. The 885,000 subscribers that Sprint wasn't actually serving represents nearly 30% of Sprint's Lifeline subscriber base and nearly 10% of the entire Lifeline program subscriber base. Providers in the low-income program receive a $9.25 monthly subsidy for most Lifeline subscribers and must pass the savings along to consumers. For most consumers served by the mobile Lifeline product marketed by Sprint and many other providers, the subsidy makes the service free to the consumer. The FCC said that under its non-usage rule, providers of free service may only be reimbursed for a Lifeline subscriber if that subscriber has used the service at least once in the past 30 days. The commission added that providers must de-enroll inactive subscribers after giving them 15 days notice. The FCC didn't say exactly how much money Sprint received through its violation of the non-usage rule. 1 month's worth of $9.25 payments for 885,000 subscribers would amount to $8.2 million. FCC Commissioner Jeffrey Starks issued a statement saying that Sprint appears to have unlawfully obtained at least tens of millions of dollars that should have gone to our lowest income communities. The non-usage rule is meant to protect Lifeline from wasting payments on service not provided. The FCC said previous investigations show that companies hawk free Lifeline service aggressively and indiscriminately, knowing that they would get paid each month even if consumers didn't use their phones. And because the consumer paid nothing, he or she had no incentive to relinquish the subscription. The 30-day limit and 15-day notice requirement were imposed by the FCC in 2016 under then-chairman Tom Wheeler. Previously, the non-usage period was 60 days and the notice requirement was 30 days. Sprint said that an error occurred in July 2017 when it implemented the FCC-mandated changes to the method for calculating usage and eligibility of Lifeline subscribers. Sprint said it reported the mistake on its own and that it will send the money back to the government. When the error was discovered, we immediately investigated and proactively raised the issue with the FCC and appropriate state regulators. We also engaged an independent third party to review the results of our review and the effectiveness of our operational changes. While immaterial to Sprint's financial results, we are committed to reimbursing federal and state governments for any subsidy payments that were collected as a result of the error. The investigation into Sprint began while FCC commissioners are still considering whether to approve the acquisition of Sprint by T-Mobile. Pai announced his support for the merger in May, and last month he asked fellow commissioners to approve the merger. Attorney generals from 17 states and the District of Columbia are challenging the merger in court, however. Commissioner Starks, who is part of the FCC Democratic minority, said the FCC should halt the merger proceeding. The draft order to approve the merger relies heavily on information submitted by Sprint, a company alleged to have overcollected Lifeline support and inaccurately accounted for nearly 1 million inactive Lifeline accounts. How the merging parties were going to handle Lifeline was a prominent part of their merger pitch, so I am alarmed and concerned about such a massive inaccuracy in a core part of the transaction. There is no credible way that the merger before us can proceed until this Lifeline investigation is resolved and the responsible parties are held accountable, Stark said. If Sprint had voluntarily provided this information and the FCC has oversight, what investigation did they provide? Nothing. We expect the FCC to have implemented the appropriate procedures for audit. Benjamin Rockwell, in his continuing IT Pro series, presents part 1 of 3 on bringing your own device to work.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and it's time to get down to business. That's right. This is where I give you tidbits from my past experience of being an IT professional for a few decades now. And this week, and actually for the next 2 weeks, we're doing a 3-part series on BYOD. That's D as in David, bring your own device. All right. So this is something that we have now. This exists right now. But I remember almost, it was back in 1997. I worked for this commercial real estate brokerage. Now, a commercial real estate brokerage is a little bit different than your standard real estate brokerage. I want you to think about this for just a moment. Your standard real estate, I think, you know, your Century 21, your Keller Williams, things like that. They sell houses. That's residential real estate. A commercial real estate brokerage will deal in big, huge, high-rise office buildings. They'll deal with strip malls. They'll deal with multi-unit family dwellings like apartment complexes. So when you're dealing with something like that, the salespeople, the real estate brokers, they are very highly paid. However, they also, well, they may not be successful for quite a while. So what does that mean? That means it's feast or famine for a lot of them. They either have a lot of money or they don't have any money. And when they're working for their first job, their first sale, they don't have any money. And it may take them 6 months to a year to develop all of the contacts, to determine what those contacts wish to purchase, and then sell them that apartment complex, for instance. Now, at the commercial real estate brokerage that I worked with, one of their requirements was that everybody bring their own computers. Why? Because, well, you were keeping information on that computer. It was a situation where you were an independent contractor of sorts. Think like Uber, but for selling big, huge office buildings, something like that. So, you know, you bring your own car for Uber. In this case, you brought your own PC for all of the different commercial real estate brokerage things that you were doing. Now, the company did commit to a healthy infrastructure. What is an infrastructure? An infrastructure is all of the different network cabling, all of the different connections out to the internet. They provided servers, but they also provided a number of different industry-specific software packages. Packages that would tell you where people were interested in living. Things like what were the values of different pieces of property? How much did this particular office building sell for this apartment complex? Think like Zillow kind of information. That's actually referred to as GIS. And that was a lot of different information that came with this. So the various different real estate brokers would bring their own computers. Now, when they brought their own computers, there was a bit of diversity. Now, we're going back a long way in time. This is in 97. Windows 98 was not even ready to come out until just very shortly after I started. So we had to deal with people who had Windows 95 machines and Windows 3.1.1. We actually had a few people bring in DOS machines. Actually, our email software worked on a base of DOS. It was kind of scary. Microsoft Mail. Wow, we're going back into the dark ages. That's something that I don't think I've talked about in many years. So anyways, we put all this together. When you have such a diversity involved there, you have to be a jack of all trades. We had, yes, a couple of different versions of Windows, but we had probably amongst 50 PCs just at the location where I was at, maybe 60 PCs. We had a wide variety of different hardware packages, probably in the neighborhood from your custom build your own kind of computer all the way on up to, you know, very early iterations of maybe Gateway and Dell and eMachines, I think, was out at that time. A lot of different companies all competing in that same space with all kinds of different hardware. So yes, along the way, we had to work with a lot of different things, including the occasional Mac. Yeah, even though we officially didn't support it, well, we had to. Now, I will get into some of the different intricacies of this when we get into the next couple of episodes of this. But we had to go through and we had to support all kinds of equipment. That was, again, back in 97. Bring your own device was not only something that was just we had to support, we enforced supporting that. Now things have changed. Things are definitely going in a different direction, and today's users demand a certain level of support for their own devices. They demand that IT come forward and take on whatever different problem that might be there, even if it doesn't even reside with the responsibility of the corporate IT. Users still demand that kind of level of support, but we'll talk about that next week. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Is the Internet of Things ready for prime time? Instead of making a declarative statement, let's look at the facts. What happened last week with a Wisconsin couple is not an isolated case. The Wisconsin couple described a chilling moment that a hacker cranked up their heat and started talking to them through a Google Nest camera in their kitchen. They said a hacker tapped into their smart home devices and cranked up their heat, talked to them through a camera, and played vulgar music. In a statement of the incident, Google said Nest was not breached and that it encouraged users to use two-factor verification to secure their accounts against hacks. This isn't the first time smart home devices have been targeted by hackers. A Northern California family said in January they had experienced 5 minutes of sheer terror after their Nest camera was hacked and warned them of a North Korean missile attack. The Wisconsin couple said a hacker accessed their smart home devices and terrorized them over a 24-hour period by cranking up the heat and talking to them through a camera. Samantha Westmoreland said that the episode began when she arrived home after work last week and discovered their Google Nest thermostat was set to 90 degrees. Westmoreland said she didn't suspect a hacker was involved until she and her husband heard a voice talking to them through a Nest camera in their kitchen. The hacker also played vulgar music through the camera. "My heart was racing," said Westmoreland. "I felt so violated at that point." The couple said they believed that their wireless internet system was compromised, which enabled the hacker to gain access to their smart home device. In a statement on the incident, Google said Nest was not breached. These reports are based on customers using compromised passwords exposed through breaches on other websites. In nearly all cases, two-factor verification eliminates this type of serious risk, the company said. Nest users have the option to migrate to a Google account, giving them access to additional tools and automatic security protections such as suspicious activity detection, two-step verification, and security checkup. Millions of users have signed up for two-factor verification. Well, if two-factor verification eliminates this type of security risk, then why wasn't this the only option you have to activate the system? Why did Google knowingly offer the one-factor verification? Let's go one step further. It seems most communication equipment is sold with a standardized or default password that needs to be changed, and if the user doesn't change it, it will be operational with the default password. If for any reason a factory reset was needed, the manufacturer's default password is, of course, reinitiated. This is an engineering design that did not take into account the usability of the equipment. The ideal situation is if the default password is detected, you must activate the hardware locally with the user-generated password to be operational. If a two-factor verification is needed, so be it. In this way, it will make the equipment more secure. Microsoft has the right idea with Windows 10. It requires you, the user, to generate the password and you, the user, to want to have a two-factor verification. If you want to work around this, you need to have local access to the system to reset initialization of the operating system. With all these external add-on devices, it is indeed a network of things connected to each other. Each manufacturer has their own methodology for system initialization. When different equipment manufacturers are used with each other, how do we know there's no connecting vulnerability? This is a major issue with Internet of Things. This is akin to drug interaction with each other. As you add medication to what has previously been prescribed to you, There is no reference information on negative interaction as you add on multiple combinations of medication. The net inclusion is, with most of the Internet of Things devices, they are not ready for prime time. The Internet of Things. How is consumer adoption of the Internet of Things evolving, and what are typical use cases and connected devices? The Internet of Things is changing our lives, often without us even knowing or realizing it, because the Internet of Things is such a broad phenomenon with so many applications and technologies. Now there is reference to the consumer Internet of Things, which refers to the Internet of Things in the context of consumer applications, use cases, and devices. Smart home is the most popular consumer Internet of Things use case. The difference between the Internet of Things and the consumer Internet of Things mainly lies in the types of devices and applications. There are also huge differences between typical consumer devices and applications in the consumer electronic space, such as smartwatches or smart thermostats on one hand, and industrial devices and applications such as freight monitoring in transportation, intelligent manufacturing systems, or Internet of Things with building management solutions on the other. In practice, when you segment vast and complex realities, there are also many overlapping applications from several perspectives. However, de facto, most people now simply speak about IoT or the Internet of Things, whether it's industrial or consumer or anything else. As always, the most popular term is the one that people use most. Still, all terminology aside, it does make sense to look at the differences. The differences lie in the types of devices and applications, the technologies which power them, and their purpose, but in the end, it's all Internet of Things, and there are as much overlap as there are differences. Consumer Internet of Things applications can range from very simple and cheap ones such as personal fitness devices to high-end smart home automation applications. So, the Internet of Things use cases, devices, and applications for consumers are very diverse as well. Moreover, as said, they often overlap with those in the more industrial and business-oriented situations. Take the case of wearables or wearable devices and clothing. In general, some are made for personal usage. Others are built for professional industrial usage as those used in factories or in mines for, among us, the safety of workers. Some of these Internet of Things use cases exist both in industrial markets and in consumer markets. We call them cross-industry Internet of Things use cases, and there are loads of them. Take asset tracking and the Internet of Things, for example. As a consumer, you might want to do asset tracking, knowing the location of things or even creatures like pets, which are really valuable for you. In big mining companies, factories, or smart city applications, however, they like to track important assets too. The solutions and applications are different, the use case more or less the same, but what you probably won't do as a consumer, however, is combine asset tracking with, for instance, asset monitoring for maintenance purposes, or combine asset tracking with the usage of sensors which, together in real time, shows levels of pollution in urban areas. You get the picture, and there are more examples where we look at the main consumer Internet of Things applications and use cases, as well as some cross-industry use case where the consumer sector is included. The IAB, which is the Interactive Advertising Bureau, commissioned Moru Matchbox to conduct a consumer study to gain visibility into consumer adoption of connected devices and the Internet of Things in order to inform the industry, and the public for that matter, about this exciting new technology and emerging market. The study was conducted among 1,200 consumers, representatives of the U.S. adult population, in order to understand who uses connected devices, which devices, how they use them, how often they use them, and how frequently, if at all. They engaged these devices with their smartphones, tablets, and computers. The devices examined included connected cars, internet-enabled home control devices and systems, internet-enabled appliances, smartwatches and wearable health trackers, internet-enabled voice command systems, connected smart TVs, virtual reality headsets, and smart glasses. The research further sought to discover how owners of these devices learn about them and how receptive they are to advertising on their devices or potentially on the devices they're connected to. Among those who don't own a connected device, the research sought to gain interest in how many of them have heard of each device, how interested they are in the device, and how they perceive the devices. The study also aimed to reveal consumer interest in upcoming technologies like self-driving cars and wearable fabrics, as well as existing technologies like smartphone voice control systems, store apps, and beaconing, smart labels, and of course, games like Pokemon Go. Connected Internet of Things consumer device buying intent turned out to be highest in areas such as connected and smart TV, connected streaming devices, connected car applications, wearables, certainly with regards to health tracking, as is confirmed by other sources, home control devices and systems in general, voice command systems. The mention of Internet of Things enabled appliances, virtual reality, and all types of smart watches. Buying interest in smart glasses is still a relatively small, but this is becoming a big one. In other research conducted by IDC, that consumer Internet of Things will become the third biggest industry in terms of spending globally by 2020. So what were the 10 most popular Internet of Things applications? Here are the rankings based on the web analysis. What percentage of those that were surveyed were interested in or have smart home automation? 100%. Wearable devices? 63%. Smart city? 34%. Smart grid? 28%. Industrial internet? 25%. Connected car? 19%. Connected health? 6%. Smart retail? 2%. Smart supply chain? 2%. And smart farming? 1%. These are the most popular Internet of Things according to the Internet of Things online store. And it is projected that in the year 2020, in the United States, it will be a $300 billion industry. The internet gave us the opportunity to connect in ways we could never imagine were possible. The Internet of Things will take us beyond connection to become part of a living, moving, global nervous system beyond imagination. By 2020, an estimated 50 billion devices around the globe will be connected to the internet. It is estimated that a third of them will be computers, smartphones, mobile devices, and TVs. The remaining two-thirds will be other kinds of things such as sensors, actuators, and newly invented intelligent devices that monitor, control, analyze, and optimize our world. Internet of Things market is expected to grow from $655 billion to $1.7 trillion in 2020. The Internet of Things is upon us. Web 1.0 was about computers connecting to their data, and Web 2.0 was about people connecting to their data. Web 3.0 is about everything connecting to everything. Drones, driverless cars, smartphones, smart homes, augmented reality, wearable technology, intelligent sensors, robotic devices are all going to make our living easier. GE, Google, Siemens, Bosch, and Philips, Cisco, Intel, Apple, Microsoft, and Samsung are all busy building the blocks of the Internet of Things. The Nest, Oculus, Basis, Dropcam, SmartThings, and Revolve are changing the way people think and work. The Internet of Things opened a plethora of new business opportunities for all. These opportunities tend to fall into three broad strategic categories, each reflecting a different type of enterprise. The first is enablers. Technology-oriented companies such as Cisco, Google, HP, IBM, and Intel that develop and implement the underlying technology. Next are the engagers that design, create, integrate, and deliver Internet of Things services like the Nest Learning Thermostat, Apple HomeKit, Hue, Tag, Mojio, and SenCity to customers. And then you also have enhancers that devise their own value-added services on top of the services provided by engagers that are unique to the Internet of Things, such as on-farm and progressive snapshot. Internet of Things will optimize operations, boost productivity, and save in resource and costs. The Internet of Things is expected to also make impacts in manufacturing, healthcare, retail, security, and transportation. The Internet of the future will go from doing things when we ask to do things before we ask. Internet of applications are exploding in almost all industries: home automation, wearables, smart gadgets, healthcare, trackers, toys, and pets. On the consumer side, there are nearly endless combinations of applications. The day is not far when our refrigerators will order milk based on specified reorder levels, and our cars will make their own service appointments. Till then, we just have to brush our own teeth, polish our own shoes, and wait for the industry to develop the necessary security integration and develop privacy rules so that we may be able to operate all our devices with integrity. At the present time, it's premature to say it is ready for prime time. Let's hope it's ready in a very short period of time. Marty Winston with his technology perspectives, talking about the new rules for power tools.
I'll bet your great-great-grandfather almost certainly owned a set of screwdrivers, a ruler, and a drill or two. It might have been an egg-beater-style hand drill or maybe one of those offset crank drills, but whatever it was, it made holes, sooner or later, and maybe occasionally, it made sore arms. In some less ancient time, one of your more recent ancestors, well, probably owned a power drill, right? Might have been a Sears Craftsman or a Black & Decker. Well, those, for example, chances are it got its power from an AC outlet, ran at just one speed, and it was a faster, more pleasant way to make those holes. Fast forward to now. You can still buy electric drills, but the chances are you'll end up owning more than one and probably use them for different kinds of jobs. Anyway, that's typical of today's tool owners. So, yeah, there are new rules for power tools. New rules for power tools. Yeah, new rules for power tools because there's new tech. And you may know about some of it. Now, I'm betting there are some recent developments that will interest you. I'm going to divide this into seven technology areas: LEDs, lasers, brushless motors, 3D drills, batteries, work lights, and trends. My focus here is primarily on hand tools and some bench tools, but some of this also applies to yard tools. And one more thing. Think about the holidays ahead. I know we have some listeners. I know you're really not into using tools yourselves, but you may be thinking about getting somebody a new tool as a gift. So maybe some of this can help, well, can help you make a better choice. And even before we get into the tech, let me add one personal comment. I keep checking out the tools at Harbor Freight, and I have never bought a single power tool there, and I probably never will. My philosophy is that a lower price is only a better value when the quality of the deliverable is at par. And I personally don't believe that they deliver the same trustworthy quality that I find in the tools sold by places like Home Depot or Lowe's. Okay, enough of the bitter. Let's get into the sweet. We'll start with LEDs. Very specifically, the little white LED lights that are built into the tool and aimed at the place you most need to see when using the tool. For a drill, it's the point where the tip of the drill bit meets the surface it's about to have a hole in it. For a power screwdriver, well, it's ahead of the screw. Hey, hasn't that been around for a while? Yeah, well, sure, but there were some goofs early on. Some of the lights were too far back, meaning all you saw at the place where you needed the light was a shadow of your hand or a shadow of the tool itself. It's much better on newer tools, brighter and aimed better, and sometimes there's more than one light, which I really find helps me position things correctly. Lasers. Oh, wow, they're being used in so many cool ways. There are drill presses that can cast laser lines down on the work surface, letting you line up the work in two directions, and the point where they cross is the point where the hole will go. Saws, too, can cast laser lines along their cut lines and take a lot of the guesstimating out of making the cut exactly where you want to make it. Self-leveling layout lasers can cast right-angle lines in three dimensions, and that's a huge help in making sure things stay straight and square. Some even add 45-degree lines for laying out things like tiles. Lasers built into non-contact infrared thermometers cast dots to show you the point where it's reading the temperature. And there are some very accurate short-range and long-range distance-measuring gizmos that use the time of flight of light along a laser beam to find the distance from the instrument to the dot that it casts. You may have heard of brushless motors, and most people who have just don't get what that's all about. And don't worry, I'm not going to go explain how they work or anything. Here's what I will tell you. They keep working many times longer without failing. They're much more efficient, so any given battery can give you some combination of higher speeds or more kick, meaning more torque, more power, more oomph. And they can usually keep running longer on a freshly charged battery. You may have never seen a brush on a motor, and no, I'm not talking about the vacuum cleaner roller. The brush is an electrical connection, and it's the most likely point of failure for any motor-powered tool. So, to keep it simple, if there's a choice, choose the tool with the brushless motor. I mentioned 3D drills, also useful as 3D screwdrivers, but if you think of it, every drill ends up pushing the drill bit down, and every screwdriver moves a fastener or screw head up or down. So let me try to be more specific. Simple electric drills and simple electric screwdrivers, or the modern double-duty thing called a drill driver, clever, huh? They just spin. They just go around in circles. Sometimes, like maybe when you're trying to drill a hole or drive a screw into concrete blocks in your basement, sometimes just spinning either can't get the job done or it takes forever. These days, there are drills that drive their heads up and down at the same time as they spin. Depending on how hard the bang of that up and down impact turns out to be, they may be called pulse drills or impulse drills or, at the really macho end, hammer drills. I once tested a cinder block task with a standard drill and standard drill bit versus a hammer drill with an impact-rated drill bit. The hammer drill cut the time down from 18 minutes to 22 seconds. The standard bits broke twice and got too hot to touch, but the impact bits were fine. And when it comes to using them on screws, they can muscle really tight, sometimes even corrosion-locked screws into submission. Let's talk about the juice to run these new tools. There are some tools you may still want to plug into a wall, bigger drill presses and table saws, for example, although there are some cordless products in both categories. Today's tool batteries are beefier. Their chargers are smarter. They deliver more power and deliver power longer. That's the amp hours or AH specs that you see. They fade less. They have a longer working life, even at uncomfortable temperatures. And some of them have some crazy techie features, like Bluetooth charge monitoring and an anti-theft mode that disables the battery if somebody, shall we say, borrows it without asking. Today's batteries make today's cordless tools uncompromising, full-power, high-utility choices. One note, though, each brand has one or more battery families, often based on voltages, and there's no one brand's batteries that will work on any other brand. No adapters either. Do your homework. Or if it's a gift, find out what tools the recipient is already using. Work lights. Not talking about the ones built into the tools, but the separate lights you may need to bring to where you're working can be amazing these days. Lots of brightness, long run times on batteries, flexible mounting options, and other good things. It's all because of LEDs, of course. And the newer the model of light you buy, the better it's likely to be at those things. Keep an eye open for those that can light up where you're working without beaming into your eyes the whole time. And there are some wearable lights that can also help with that. Choices galore. You may have picked up one overriding trend here. Contemporary battery-operated cordless tools are now strong enough, beefy enough, to take over more jobs that used to require plugging a cord into AC power, not to mention some jobs that used to require gasoline engine power. One contractor friend joked that what you save on extension cords will help pay for spare batteries. Okay, you can now consider yourself up to date on new rules for power tools and how LEDs, lasers, brushless motors, 3D drills, better batteries, and better worksite lighting make it all, well, better. Next time, well, think about how your summer place, including all the stuff you kept in your yard, ends up invading your living space when fall and wintry weather compels a move indoors. And also, some of what happens to everything that was already indoors, including you, as a result. I hope to show how to save you some grief and maybe some money.
Thank you, Marty. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open free to the public. The Westchester PC User Group has a presentation on online privacy Thursday, October the 3rd. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road at White Plains, New York. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has their meeting on Friday, October the 4th. They start their meeting at 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, located at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on genealogy, Thursday, October the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at NYU Silver Building, 32 Waverly Place, room 408, and that's in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group meet Friday, October the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Harry J. Schur Hall at the New York Institute of Technology, located at Old Westbury Campus, out in Old Westbury, New York. We hope to see you at one of these meetings. And if you have a computer club meeting you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm on the Internet and pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and until we meet again, same time, same station next week.